The Coptic Magical Papyri Podcast. Dear listeners and magic enthusiasts, welcome to our first podcast episode. Today we are discussing Coptic magic with the Leiden professor Jacques van der Vliet. Jacques van der Vliet is the first guest in our series of lectures held at the Institute of Egyptology at the University of Würzburg. Before we begin, an introduction of our guest is required. Jacques van der Vliet is currently Josef M.A. Jensen Professor of Religions of Ancient Egypt at the Faculty of Philosophy, Theology and Religious Studies at the Roundabout University Nijmegen. He is also affiliated researcher at the Institute for Area Studies of the Leiden University, visiting research fellow of the Netherlands Institute for the Near East in Leiden, and staff member at the Institute for Eastern Christian Studies at the Roundabout University Nijmegen. Jacques van der Vliet was president of the International Association for Coptic Studies between 2012 and 2016, and among his research interests are Coptic texts from the first millennium in their cultural context with a focus on Gnostic and apocryphal texts, magic, papyrology, and epigraphy, including that of Christian Nubia. I sincerely hope that you will enjoy our first podcast episode.
Could you, in your own words, describe what you are actually doing, or which one of these roles is the most important to you?
Well, to me, the most important thing is that I'm basically a Coptologist. I don't like these terms so much, with list Egyptologist, Coptologist, but that's what I'm basically doing. You know, I'm a person who likes to work on Coptic text and with Coptic text. Mm-hmm. We just had a discussion about magic, and you know, I'm interested in the magical text, and I'm interested in particular in those magical texts that give Coptic magical text that give me the pleasure in puzzling, in decipherment, not only in the sense of reading them, but in trying to understand them. And that's the most important, for me, the most important part of, next to that, I also teach and have been teaching courses in ancient Egyptian religion.
When we introduce someone, we say all these titles and people don't really understand what is behind them.
No, so, behind them is simply one same person who's interested in Coptic text, but the idea, of course, that you use the text to understand a past society and to reconstruct the intellectual world of people in a particular period, mm-hmm. in late antiquity or early medieval period in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. This might be a very basic question, but why Coptic and why magical texts? Could you give a simple answer to this?
Not a simple answer, because the answer is inevitably connected with my own personal history. So I started out as a student of Egyptology, and began my studies in Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam at the time, there was the professor of, that was also an extraordinary professorship, was Jan Zandé. And Jan Zandé did lots of Coptic. So I came there as a young student, and in addition to learning hieroglyphs, we had to read a lot of Coptic, and I didn't like it at all. But at a certain moment I started to like it, because Jan Zandé was working on the first edition of the so-called Tractatus Tripartitus, that is a very long Gnostic treatise from what is today called the first codex of the Nag Hammadi find. And so he was working on it, he was participating in this first edition, and we had to read things with him from the photocopies of the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I hadn't decided to become a Copticist or a Coptologist, but thought about becoming an art historian, so I hesitated for some time. I stuck with Egyptology after a while,
mm-hmm.
and then I spent almost 1 year and a half in Cairo, and that was wonderful for various reasons. One of the reasons was, of course, the discovery that there were living Copts who used Coptic in during Holy Mass. And the other thing was that the then director of the Institute, who was an Arabist, rather a well-known Arabist, in he doesn't live anymore, Hans Janssen, who was himself very much interested in Oriental Christians, so to say, in Coptic communities, and also in languages, so in Coptic and Syriac and so on. So he had a very wide interest, and he stimulated me to continue with Coptic. So coming back from Cairo in 1982, I went back to my former professor Jan Sondé to do some Coptic with him. I'm still much interested in Gnosticism and in Gnostic texts, because they are challenging. Drew my interest to apocryphal texts and to magical texts as well. Also got interested from that time onwards in the say the ritual or magical aspects of the Gnostic writings, which are simply not, you know, some of them are more theological, but others are not. They're often simply a ritual text that need to be read aloud, and you have kind of magical elements therein. Yeah, the 1992 Coptic Congress was in Washington, and but following up on this meeting in Washington, there was in Lawrence, Kansas, a conference on magic. So when I was talking with, and apparently I had time, so entirely unplanned, me and my wife, we went from Washington to Lawrence, Kansas in the Midwest to join. And well, yeah, I apparently improvised a lecture also for this conference, which is actually not the lecture which was not the same as the paper that was published in the proceedings of the I contributed the paper to the proceedings, but my lecture there was already on the Horus Isis spells and certain aspects thereof, which I did not publish. But anyhow, it stimulated me to go on. And I was very nicely received in Lawrence, Kansas, and there I met David Frankfurter and late Marvin Meyer, mm-hmm. with whom I also remained in contact. So that was nice. Meanwhile, of course, I defended my thesis finally, my doctoral dissertation finally in 1996. So that had taken some time, as you may guess. But then I was asked for something else. But the interest in magic, I was asked for an epigraphy project for a publication of inscriptions in Khartoum. So I almost immediately after my defense went to Khartoum, which was another interesting experience. But the interest in the magic remained. And then I was asked for following up on this stay in Khartoum by the same person who had organized my stay in Khartoum, Wodek Gotlewski from mm-hmm. Warsaw. He asked me then for the Nakhlun excavations. And what happened in the Nakhlun excavations? There were again magical texts mm-hmm. found, and one of them very interesting, which we discussed yesterday a bit. Which proved to contain all kinds of food for thought. So from that moment on, I started thinking about this, indeed about a project about Christianizing magic. How did the change happen, what can you say about the transmission of traditional elements on the one hand, and on the other hand on the change of traditional practices into Christian practices.
I would now like to ask you, how do you personally define magic, and where would you draw the line between magic and religion?
Well, first of all, I will say this, is a very difficult question, of course. And personally, I don't have a real definition of magic. There are many, and that is simply something very difficult, and something that is due to remain rather theoretical. One definition of magic is rather practical, I would say. So there is a corpus, a body of text, Coptic text, that's what I'm most interested in. I mean, Greek is also interesting, of course, but I'm interested basically in what comes out of from Egypt. Body of text that we call magical texts.
How would you define a magical text, and what attributes does it have to have?
Well, it doesn't have to be a magical text. Well, it doesn't have to have. Yeah, that's a very difficult question. Once more, because you cannot give. You would like to give visible examples, but they are structured often in a particular way. They often have drawings. They have a certain fixed formats with prayers and with practical parts of it that give instructions for the ritual to follow, and of course, what is very important, they are not theology. They are not liturgy in the proper understanding, in the limited understanding that we have of Christian liturgy, but they serve practical purposes. Mm-hmm. So that they solve problems in everyday life. However complicated or difficult a magical text may be, they have some kind of practical purpose. They solve a crisis in daily life that may be concerning health, that may be concerning sex, or that may be concerning a lack of information about your future, or that kind of thing. So they are, however obscure and abstruse they may be, they are practically oriented. They often follow similar formats, and in particular, many of the later examples also are characterized by a kind of script that is something, in between literary hands and documentary hands, and that sometimes looks as if it is clumsy, but it's perhaps not.
Are the magical texts also archaeologically different or not?
Up to a degree, they are different also as artifacts. Of course, you have, say, papyrus scrolls, you have codices with a magical purpose, but often they have their own materiality. They are materially and visually different from other genres of text. So they are, of course, in any genre, of course, there are marginal cases, and with magical text, there's lots of variation, and there are lots of marginal cases. So it's difficult to be very to give a definition that encompasses everything. But in general, also, magical texts are different as artifacts. An example of a book that could have been simply a kind of liturgical or literary text, that is the small Anastasi Codex from the museum in Leiden. That has a nice literary hand. It's very well written, it's nicely bound, and so on and so on. That looks like a perfectly normal book, actually.
So we discern applied text and formulary text, and the difference being the applied texts work more as amulets and the formularies describe how a ritual should be done. So there is this difference that one is a practical object that was used as an amulet, and the other one is like a manual on how to do a Coptic ritual. Can you think of any example in the ancient magic or ancient world of similar types of texts or of similar types of divisions of texts, one being a practical one and one being a theoretical one?
I think it could be, yeah. I think that's, for example, with liturgical texts, you may also have, say, the books for really for liturgical use, and the books or even perhaps loose leaves that people would use for private purposes. So I can imagine that there is a certain that could offer a certain analogy.
There is a lot of tiptoeing around the word magic. Is it useful to use it or is it not? For example, in the book Ancient Christian Magic, the authors use the term ritual power on the other hand, in a more recent text, Joseph Sanzo is advocating for the use of the term magic. So where do you stand in this discussion?
I mean, it says something about the text. It says something about what the texts do, and it avoids the term magic, which, of course, is a very difficult term because it implies a whole world of negative judgment, condemnation, condemned practices, secrecy, and so on. So it is a concept with a bad press, so to say. Still, I think I agree with Joe Sanso rather that it is useful to use the word because it has some correspondence in the reality of text and artifacts, and that's what actually both Joe and I am interested in. We are both interested in. So in that case, I would say, use this term, but be careful about it. And of course, you should be very, very careful about it because, for example, the text that I published together with Adam Weitar from the tomb of an archbishop of Dongola, even the whole practice of decorating such the inside of such a burial chamber with text could be qualified as magic, but on the other hand, it is difficult to assume that an archbishop would even allow or let alone favor the use of such texts in this context if he considered them magic, that's to say, undesirable ritual. So you should be very careful about the text and always, make very clear that how you use the text, whether you use the text from an emic or an edic perspective. Of course, that's an old debate already. So you should be careful in using the text, but I think you can use the text. You can use the word, I'm sorry.
How do you view the relationship between monasticism and magical text? This is a very discussed question, and we'd like to know your opinion.
That's a much discussed question. It's a difficult question to answer because, as it happens, much of our material simply comes from monastic contexts. That holds for all Coptic material, written material, that simply most of what we have from Coptic derives not from the cities, because we don't have these cities anymore. They are overbuilt and overbuilt and overbuilt till today. But we have them from more or less marginal regions where the monasteries were. So there is a strong suggestion within the material that magic and monasticism are, say, as coupled in a very strong way. This is not necessarily correct, of course. The archaeological provenance of our material favors such a hypothesis of the close connection. This being said, We, of course, have indeed, from monastic context, we have ample evidence of, well, say, magical activity. Yeah, even such a monastery as that of Nacloon. Yeah, both in the hermitages, in the small, in the mountains, and in the buildings on the plateau, we found magical material. There is a famous passage from Shenute that says that already that also from which it is apparent that already in the fifth century, the first half of the fifth century, monks and magical practices were say associated. So there's this famous passage where it says Shenute quotes somebody, a wealthy person, who says, "Yes, I do this and this. I tie something to my arms because it was a famous monk who told me to do this." Yeah, and it is quite likely, as David Frankfurter has once more has suggested, of course, that that in the general appeal that holy monks had for their followers, for people who were coming to them, that say healing practices or kind of praying practices played and perhaps also what we would call magic played a certain role. That's also the picture that David Frankfurter sketches. You know, they had a kind of holy men that were kind of general practitioners, and you know, that everything that involved appeal to God or to the divine world, so to say. Yeah, that's simply true. And another thing that we should consider is that you also get the that it may very well be that, for example, also other lower clergy, like deacons, that again suggested by the Ethiopian model, that other lower clergy, like deacons in Egypt, and in that case, would also be involved in this kind of practice. Deacons, of course, still today play an important role within the church, because they are kind of they are kind of literate persons who read the readings during Mass and are more accessible than priests. You know. And of course, deacons they had knowledge of Scripture, because deacon should be able to read from the Scriptures, should be able to assist during the Holy Mass. So he has ritual and theological knowledge that would allow him also to do this kind of things.
In contemporary literature on the subject of ancient magic, there is oftentimes a dichotomy created between the magicians or magical practices and those who despised magic. So these could be members of the Christian church or those who represented a more traditional religion that were opposed to magical practices. And how do you understand this opposition? Do you think this is a discourse that is created by the surviving material we have? Or was this really somehow reality? Was there a strong opposition between the church and magical practices, even though magical practices probably had some kind of connection to monastic life?
Yeah, I see your question. But, of course, a certain kind of literature is simply there, exists, because it has to draw boundaries. Yeah, I mean, if a bishop is preaching a sermon, yeah, he should, yeah, be able to say what to do and what not to do. Yeah, and it holds even more for canonical literature. Yeah, canonical literature should condemn certain practices and should condone other practices, support other practice. This is the ethic point of view. Yeah, and then on the other hand, of course, you have all kinds of people who do whatever they like. Yeah, that is I think normal. There is a whole There are theoretical models for this kind of behavior, and the most famous is perhaps this Redfieldian model of that you have the great tradition and the small tradition, and the small tradition draws on the great tradition, but it's not the same. And the great tradition is this, the world of, say, theology, the official creed. And the small tradition is everything that derives from it, respects it, but draws upon it, but may consist in all kinds of rituals that are not, for example, that are not strictly spoken church rituals.
It seems as though in contemporary literature there is something that David Brecky calls micro-studies, which is a tendency to focus solely on one text and its context, rather than trying to get from the material an overarching theory. So this basically means that scholars should focus on one single text in its context, or in comparison to other similar texts, rather than trying to create, as I said, a big overarching theory. Do you agree with this concept of micro-studies? This concept was also talked about by David Brecky in his book on Gnosticism.
Well, I'm very much in sympathy with this position, because my own point of departure is always actually a text. Mm-hmm. I'm not a theoretician. You know, I like to have a text. And then a text in itself is already a small world. And you should try to explain a text, for example, a Gnostic text or a magical text. So, first of all, within its own terms, trying to understand what it wants to say in a very direct sense, and then only when you more or less understand the text and what it says, you can try to reconstruct the broader landscape from which the text may have originated. But of course, what my next step always is to look for a social context rather than for a theological building.
Are there any common elements between Gnostic texts and magical texts? Do you see any influences of Gnostic traditions on magical texts?
There are definitely common elements, and I think they have something to do with the fact that also many of these Gnostic texts are not what they, of course, were thought to be at first in the first period of study of Gnosticism, theological treatises, but rather texts to be read aloud in a community, within a community, texts with clear liturgical elements, texts in which the plotting of higher powers plays an important part. So there are certainly contexts, and that these contexts, in my opinion, have something to do with the ritual part of Gnosticism. You know, they are not just they are not just theological treatises, or most of them are even not at all theological treatises, but texts that give, for example, insight in how the heavenly world is conceived, and I'll come back to one of my old subjects, of course, how evil came into being. Yeah, and these things, for example, indeed the construction of a world that is conceived as evil, that's experienced as evil, takes up a large place in many Gnostic writings. So this is repeated again and again and again and again, how something went wrong in the higher world, and then an evil world came into existence with evil rulers. That has strong To me has a strong ritual dimension, and that's where you find also the close connections between magical text and Gnostic text. For example, the best example, of course, is this enigmatic four luminaries that occur in Gnostic sources from the 2nd century onwards, till very late Coptic magical texts, and that have something to do. They have something to do with how the celestial world was conceived, conceptualized, and how to explain these parallels historically. That is a different and very difficult question. It has been suggested, for example, by the Dutch scholar Roel van den Broek, that some of the Cetean systems use an underlying kind of magical or ritual construction of the world, but they use a kind of common source. But it's very difficult to get hold of this common source, and what the nature of this common source would be is not so very obvious. But what is clear is that the whole concept of magic entered Gnostic studies since 20 years or so. If the Gnostic and the magical text derive from a kind of underlying magical system, or cosmogonical system, then how to reconstruct this? This is very difficult. I'm not, you know, that the in the publication of the Macquarie Codex, Malcolm Jowett and Ian Gardner clearly wrestled with this question. But I think Ian Gardner actually assumes that there is kind of Cetean influence in this may also be, but then we have to suppose that there was a kind of undercurrent of Cetean thinking, or I would rather think about a kind of common source which is basically angelological, if I may use this horrible word, which describe the world of the supernal spiritual beings, of the angels, how do you relate to each other, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. Both Gnostic texts and Coptic magical texts are very much interested in how this angelical world is looking like, but then also lots of apocryphal, say Catholic apocryphal literature, like the Visio Pauli or the Apocalypse of Paul, are also very much interested in how this all looks like and how it is organized. The relationship between Gnosticism and magic is put on the agenda now, but we are far, I think, from final answers, I think.
How do you imagine the magical practice in the Coptic world? Have you ever imagined it in any way?
I tried to, because everybody, I think, tries to imagine somehow how did this work, how did this go on. Well, once more, I like this Deftera model, you know, that you have learned, literate people who were, of course, not themselves bishops, but who were able to mediate between the needs of daily needs of people and the sources of Christian liturgy and scripture, and taken in a broad sense. And I think, we discussed this earlier, after all, monks and deacons were probably the kind of people who were able to play this mediating role, yeah, because they had a certain authority within Christian society. They were respected. On the one hand, and on the other hand, they had access to the literary source. When you look at the Ethiopic practices, the Ethiopian practice, I think that some practitioners must have had a certain reputation, and others perhaps also a certain reputation, but in a different field. One of the early works of Maxime Rodinson was the publication, simply publication of a list of people who were practitioners in a certain region of Ethiopia. And they had their specialities, you know. They were specialists in a certain way, or in a certain region, or in a certain field. You know, you could go to them for that is kind of fascinating reading. And somehow you have to imagine that it was in this way as well. And of course, even today, when you look around in Egypt, you see that certain monks have a certain reputation of sanctity. And people would go, if they have problems, they will go to this certain monk. Not to say that this monk will be practicing magic or so, but his prayers will be deemed more efficacious than the prayers of normal sinful monks, to say, because they are considered to be more holy than others.
How has academia changed since you were a student, and what is your prediction, let's say, for the next 10 or 20 years in the academic field or in the field of magic?
No, that's very difficult to question. You know, I started out as an Egyptologist, and of course my impression of, we discussed this afternoon as well, it was mentioned that Egyptology is for the study of religion, including magic, hopelessly backward. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was really very, so I, as a student, I felt very unsatisfied by reflection from the point of, say, study of general study of religion, in particular from study of anthropology, from which Egyptology could have profited. Of course, that changed drastically, fortunately. When I came first to the field of Coptic magic, it was almost dead, I think. Sometimes somebody published a Coptic spell or something that he or she found somewhere, but it was really dying. And then they came, as I told you, so more or less at the same time that I got interested in Coptic magic, there came these magical conferences in the United States. So the first one was in Lawrence, Kansas, and that speeded up things quite a bit. Yeah. Magic became really a domain of study. Also from the part of, I must say, from the part of the classicists, you know, they developed more sophisticated models to study the Greek magical papyri, the work of Fresnel, of course. This Henk Fresnel is, of course, must should be mentioned in this respect. So by the time I finished my doctoral dissertation, there was lots of movement, lots of development. Work of David Frankfurter was stimulating, but I knew already the work by the articles by only a few, actually, by Stanley Tambaya, David Frankfurter. But that's why I had a close friend of mine was an anthropologist, so I knew the work of Tambaya already, actually, just after it was published. But in any case, the work of Tambaya became actually a household household word in the field, and also the performative aspects of magic. So that changed the field drastically, and what direction it will take in the future, that is up to you, not anymore to me. Try to be a prophet a bit. I think, well, for the time being, you know, these kind of great themes of the, say, the well, ritual context, social context, also what I personally like very much, this idea of innovation will remain all on the agenda for the next years, at least, I think.
Thank you, Professor van der Vliet, for this lovely interview, and we are looking forward to the next podcast episode. For more information on our Coptic Magical Papyri project, please visit our website on www.coptic-magic.phil, that is phil, .uni-Würzburg, spelled WUERZBURG.DE. It should pop up when you Google Coptic Magical Papyri. Thank you very much for listening once again, and see you next time.